This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
Welcome to the Threat Post News Wrap podcast. It's been a couple of weeks since we talked to you guys. In that time, there's been a lot going on. Mike, I think I feel like we every week we start with some sort of NSA revelation, some sort of, you know, bombshell or, you know, something along those lines. Right. And there's not a huge NSA story, at least not on the level that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 months. But the story that you posted today, which is sort of tangentially related to that whole thing, I think is pretty fascinating, about this kind of grassroots movement in the security community to get the opportunity to audit the source code for TrueCrypt, which probably most of the audience knows what TrueCrypt is, but explain a little bit about how that thing came about and what these guys are trying to do.
Right. So TrueCrypt is the open source encryption stuff. It's you can encrypt files or full disks, and it's I've never used it, but apparently it's very easy to use. One of the folks I talked to for that story said it was grandma friendly. That kind of sums it up in terms of its usability. But what's going on is a group of engineers and security researchers have decided to audit the code. And basically, this is the trickle down from the NSA stuff. Trust nothing, trust no one. So they're starting to look at a lot of this open source security stuff for a lot of different reasons. And TrueCrypt, people like it. People use it. It works. But there's kind of this other side to it where the development team is pretty much a bunch of phantoms. These guys out in the ether, nobody's really sure who's behind the development and who maintains the code. The license is kind of wonky behind it. They don't think that whoever wrote the license originally was familiar with how to write licenses in terms of using the language.
Right.
You know, so what's happening is they're raising money to have the TrueCrypt code audited professionally. And they're also raising money to hire a lawyer to look at this license because there's a lot of ambiguity around it in terms of basically the way it was explained to me. The license tells you what you can't do with TrueCrypt. It doesn't tell you what you can do. So at least a lot of – you're open to litigation on a lot of different fronts. And obviously that has a lot of people worried these days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess maybe the way to go is you violate the license and then see who comes to sue you.
And then see who comes to sue you, yeah. I mean I haven't heard about any issues like that happening, but –
no.
Who knows going forward? So I guess they've raised about $35,000-$36,000.
That's crazy.
And it's basically just, you know, crowdfunding stuff. You know, people just donating to this website. And it's way beyond what they initially hoped to raise for this effort. So, you know, I think they're going to be careful in terms of I talked to Matthew Green, who is the cryptologist that everybody's been talking to over at Johns Hopkins on a bunch of different NSA stories. Mm-hmm. And he told me he was reaching out to some expert friends of his for some recommendations on a professional firm to look at the code. Another gentleman named Ken White, who's a little bit more familiar with the license end of this story than Matthew was, has some folks looking into the legal side of it. So it may take a while before you get the results of a full audit. But obviously they're looking to see whether this tool that everybody uses has been compromised. I mean, this thing's been downloaded 28 million times. And in the Windows version of it, which most people get in binary form, there's no way to compare that to the source code. And it does some funky stuff, and people aren't, you know, there's really no way to tell whether it's been compromised. Nobody's coming out and saying it overtly, but, I mean, I think, you know, if you talk to enough people, you read enough stuff, there's certainly room for suspicion.
Yeah, and obviously the big fear here is that there's a backdoor in there somewhere, which is, you know, is – not out of the realm of possibility given what we've learned in the last few months.
Right.
You know, it was probably never out of the realm of possibility with anything, but knowing what we know, you know, since June, you have to put that on the table and say, this is a real possibility. even, you know, even if you knew who the maintainers were or knew who the developers were or whatever, you know, you're not talking about, probably not talking about deliberate, you know, things, but who knows, man, the way that things are going, you know, the influence that the intelligence community exerts on some of these processes, you just, you have no idea now.
Right. And the way it was explained to me, and Matthew Green wrote a blog post on it, they will explain it far better than I ever could, but I guess when you encrypt, when you, a TrueCrypt volume is returned to you, there's an extra 65,000 bits on there that are not accounted for. So the speculation is that that could be your password that's being encrypted, and somebody else has the key.
Good.
Unlocks any volume they want to look at, some master key. Obviously, they can't tell until the code's audited and vetted and looked at very carefully. And, you know, the problem is, again, that the Windows binary just can't be compared to the source code right now. The Windows version behaves a lot differently than the Linux version. You don't get those that same byte sequence returned.
Meaning maybe the maintainers didn't really care about Linux users and thought, the Windows user base is who we...
Right.
That's some terrible conspiracy theories, but I think it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because, you know, they've raised all this money, and, you know, we and they all know plenty of people that could audit that source code, mm-hmm. you know, would happily do it, but if nobody comes forward and says, okay, here's the source code, then, you know, it's everybody just kind of yelling at each other on Twitter. But I saw somebody, today's Friday, maybe 2 days ago, somebody whose name I didn't recognize just put something on Twitter that said, I've audited the TrueCrypt source code. I don't use it. I don't use TrueCrypt. Draw your own conclusions.
I hadn't seen that, but that's interesting.
Somebody, you know, it's not somebody I follow. Somebody must have retweeted it. So I don't know who the guy was. And I went and looked at, you know, did just no information. So I'm sure that somebody has audited it, but I've never, you know, that was the first I'd heard of anybody coming forward and saying, hey, listen, I've seen it, and, you know, I'm not a user.
Yeah, so I'm sure somebody's looked at it before. I think that, you know, this effort basically wants to formalize it and kind of leave no stone unturned in terms of, you know, being very transparent about the process and, you know, being out there with who's doing it and how long it takes, and obviously presenting the results someday.
Right. Yeah, I would like to see them succeed and just, you know, one way or the other, you know, answer this question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, then again, we're all left again back at square one. What do you trust? You can't trust anything.
Yeah.
I mean, RSA, you know, kicked this off, telling everybody not to use that particular algorithm in products that are developed with RSA stuff, and now you get TrueCrypt under question. You know, what's next? Who knows?
Yeah, it's weird.
It's very weird.
Odd times, man. So the other, I guess, big story that we had on the site in the last few days is the one about the research some guys presented at Hack in the Box over in Asia. I think they probably presented it yesterday, Thursday, about that they took a really hard look at the iMessage protocol that Apple uses for you know, iPhones and iPads and everybody else that uses iMessage. And they reverse engineered it and did this really long blog post analysis and a set of slides, just really like diving into this thing and looking, you know, for security problems and seeing what Apple did right. And I wrote about it yesterday, and, you know, obviously the news, you're going to focus on what they did wrong or what the researchers think they could have done better, I guess is a better way to put it. And the thing that they, a couple of things they came up with, one that seems easy to fix is they noticed right away that there's no certificate pinning involved in the protocol. So if you can do a couple of other tricks, then you can add your own certificate authority to the keychain on iOS and then basically, you know, man in the middle of the iMessage traffic and intercept it, you know, decrypt the messages, which is a problem. And you would think that, I mean, we talked to people, I can't think of a great reason why they wouldn't have used certificate pinning in that circumstance.
Right. I mean, of all the crypto things you can do, I don't think that that's hugely resource intensive. I mean, I'm probably talking out of my head here, but from what we talk to different people, and they all say, you know, that there's really no reason why something like that can't happen.
Yeah, it's kind of an easy win. Yeah. You can just say, okay, here's the certificate that, you know, here's the valid certificate that you should expect for this resource. If you don't see that, then, you know, throw an alarm, everything, you know, things are going bad. And, you know, they did mention that, you know, listen, these messages are encrypted over SSL between, you know, the sender and Apple and the receiver and that kind of thing, which is all great. But they said, you know, the worrying part is that Apple controls the key infrastructure. So, you know, at any point they could do something with those keys if they were forced to, you know, they could hand them over to the government if they had to, which I think is something people had thought about before.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just not much transparency there. They're not allowed to tell you if they're getting national security requests for stuff like that. So you never really know. I mean, when you have that centralized kind of key management, that's problematic. I mean, there's ways to decentralize it, I guess, that might be a little bit more difficult. But, you know, like certificate pinning, that's another alternative.
Yeah, and the story sort of got a lot of attention yesterday, and a lot of people were just like, why is it set up this way? This doesn't make a lot of sense to me. A couple people said, listen, the main reason you would want to control the key infrastructure is to avoid man-in-the-middle attacks so that, you know, you could see them if they're happening,
right,
or, you know, you could defend against them. But they've also made some other choices that don't make that, you know, that don't lead down that same path. So I would imagine that if we saw, you know, we might see another presentation in 6 or 8 months where they've changed some of these things.
Right. Well, Apple will tell us. They're so open and they'll be fine.
I was waiting for a phone call all day yesterday, in fact, with the details. Absolutely. Oh, geez. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. The only way we'll ever know is if these guys go back in a year and update this presentation.
Right, right.
You know? And I was looking through their slides yesterday, and one of the slides, not a throwaway, but one of the things they just mentioned in there is that somewhere in this scheme, there's some white box, like basically like white box cryptography that Apple does that they can't see and they can't tell what it's based on, but it looks like it does its job really well. And they were sort of interested in what that might be. But, as usual, it's none of your business what that might be. just be happy that it's there.
Yeah, the walled off garden of Apple, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, absolutely. So that was kind of the big news the last couple weeks. There was I've been kind of out of the country for 2 weeks, so I haven't even seen much else of what's been going on. But there was, you know, I think the other interesting thing this week was the fact that Yahoo sort of finally got around to making SSL the default for Yahoo Mail users,
yeah,
which had been...
Only took them 3 years to catch up with Google, and a year or so with Microsoft and Facebook.
Yeah. And, I mean, when we posted that story, I got a lot of messages on Twitter. People were like, so the 4 Yahoo Mail users are now protected, you know, that kind of thing, which... Obviously, they're not as big as Gmail or Hotmail, but there's still, you know, tens of millions of users all over the world that sort of rely on that. And if they don't, you know, most people aren't going to go through the trouble of enabling HTTPS on their own and making it, you know, their default. So,
but, you know, we kid around about it, but, you know, once you're on, if Yahoo is your primary email, it's a pain to get off of it.
Oh, it's a pain to get.
People are going
to
stick with it. And if stuff like this isn't done for them, especially on the consumer end, you know, they're not going to enable HTTPS and they're not going to look for it.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I hope that most of the home users are seeing those stories and you know, knowing that this is an option for them. But, you know, I'm not totally sure. It's, you know, we're doing our best, but most of those users you would have to assume are, you know, consumer users. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know.
Right.
I don't think there's a lot of enterprise Yahoo Mail deployments.
But, you know, that story was a day after the Snowden revelation about the address books.
Oh, right. Say, yeah, that's true.
Capturing address books. And then if you look at some of the numbers in the, I think it was the Washington Post that wrote the original story about it, they did a snapshot of like one day of what the traffic that the NSA was grabbing. And I think they, in that one day, just as a comparison, they grabbed 450,000 Yahoo address books compared to 30,000 Gmail or something. Right there just tells you, you know, the risk involved.
All you need to know.
Not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. That's hopefully people will, they'll make it easy. And, you know, I would like to see some sort of like, some sort of alert for people on whatever day they make that the default option telling them that this is their, you know, and what it does for them.
Right.
So the people,
yeah, it's not like it's on the homepage. Yeah.
Oh, no. Not a chance. All right. So, yeah, I think we got everything. But how are you feeling about the Red Sox right now?
one to go as we speak here. It's pretty shocking. You know, as far as where they were a year ago, turning around to this degree, I never gave much credence to managers in baseball. But if Bobby Valentine was this much of a disaster, wow, what were they thinking a year ago? They basically haven't added a lot of quality talent to that team.
No, they really haven't. I looked at that team in the spring and I thought, come on.
I know.
Really? These guys, this is a major league team, but, I don't go in much for like that chemistry and like rah-rah type stuff, but I think there might be something to be said for it on that team. And it's just
all about the beard.
Oh my God. It's killing me. Cause I've got this terrible like reverse jinx beard going, and I need them to, get knocked out so I can shave this thing. It's driving me crazy.
You hate them that much, huh?
Yeah. And it's not working, obviously. They had no business winning the game two. I mean, that was an absolute miracle.
Oh, totally.
They won that game, and that you start winning those kind of games and you're like, oh boy,
it's gonna fall
here it goes. Yeah, it's going to start rolling. And, I really thought Detroit had, their pitching staff is ridiculous. It's absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, the Red Sox are only hitting like 150 for the entire series, but they're up 3-2 somehow. It's crazy.
Oh, man, if the Cardinals and Red Sox get in, God, just give me a pillow. It is going to be such a snooze festival.
These games are going to be like 6 hours long.
Yeah, that too.
They're going to be, oh, yeah. And, you know, you'll see Buchholz up there taking like 9 minutes between pitches. It'll be terrible. The ratings will be a disaster. You know, right now, somehow, like, Magic Johnson and Fox are trying to fix it so the Dodgers get in rather than the Cardinals.
For sure.
Nobody wants the Cardinals in there. All right. So I think we got it all. So good luck to your Red Sox.
Thanks.
Hope they win so I can get rid of this beard.
Shave.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
All right, see ya.
All right, see ya.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments of Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.